Hello, I'm Charles Woolley, and this is Providing Pediatrics, a Better Today, Healthier Tomorrow podcast where we are discussing the unique challenges of pediatric care. All right, let's get to it.
Today, I'm joined by Matthew Whaley, Angel One transport nurse here at Arkansas Children's. Matt and I will be discussing the delivery of a newborn in the field and neonatal resuscitation. Thank you for joining us. Matt, man, it's really great to have you here.
Thank you, Charles. I'm glad to be here.
I've always looked up to you and admired you, and we've collided in the emergency department
yes.
a long time ago, and we've worked some really serious cases together side by side, and that kind of bonds people, right?
Yes.
Not just in the ER, but we've flown some trips together.
That's
on
right.
Rachel One.
So, that's right.
I've always looked up to your calm spirit and way you handle yourself in those situations. Also admire your clinical prowess.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the words.
Wonderful. So I always want to start with kind of the at the very beginning, right? So okay. Let's go back to the beginning. Where are you from? Are you a local guy?
I am. I'm from Central Arkansas. I was born in North Little Rock. I lived in Northwest Arkansas for a very brief time, but I started first grade here in Central Arkansas in Bryant. I went to school all the way through at Bryant Schools and graduated there. I did 1 year at Arkansas State University. I knew I wanted to do something medical, but I wasn't sure what. So I was majoring in medical lab technology at the time and quickly realized I did not want to spend my career looking through a microscope. I ended up living in Conway with two roommates, working at a school furniture factory there, and I had just arrived home. I was all dirty from my shift, and one of my roommates was headed out. So I just asked him, where are you going? He said, well, I'm headed to the hospital. I'm going to sign up for an EMT class. And I said, oh, well, what's an EMT? And he said, oh, those are the guys that work on the ambulance. Yeah. And I said, well, what do you have to do to sign up for that? And he said, just go sign up. So I asked him then, I said, well, wait on me. I'm going to take a shower. I'll go with you. So that is how I got my start in EMS. I went to EMT school at Conway Regional under Pat and Leslie Moore, and got my EMT basic. Started working at St. Joe Hospital in Hot Springs on
okay.
the Life Mobile Ambulance Service.
Wow.
Went to paramedic school at Garland County Community College. It's now National Park Community College.
Sure.
Back then, because it was a long time ago, as Garland County Community College. So I got my paramedic certification there and worked as a paramedic for several years there. Got an opportunity then to further my career and move to East Texas.
Okay.
And I went to work at East Texas Medical Center, EMS, which was a pretty big culture shock. I went from a service that had about 8 to 10 ambulances
okay.
to a service that was running about 85 ambulances and,
wow.
four aircraft.
Gotcha.
Covering an enormous amount of territory, almost all of East Texas. So it was really good experience to see how the two different systems worked. During my time there, I was able to work my schedule out to go to nursing school.
Okay.
So I attended nursing school at Tyler Junior College in Tyler, Texas. Graduated with an associate in applied science in nursing. Then in 2004, I moved back to Arkansas and began work here at Arkansas Children's Hospital as a nurse in the emergency room. That's where we crossed paths. And then in 2013, I graduated from Western Governors University with my Bachelor of Science in Nursing. And I started on the Angel One transport team in 2013.
Thinking back to those days, early days on the ambulance, you know, I want to put you back in your BDUs, okay? I want you to give back. You guys had the Flying Cross shirts, right, back in the day?
I think that's what they were, yes.
Flying Cross shirts and the BDUs. I wasn't too far behind you. So you're there. You're getting on your shift. You're getting ready to be on the ambulance that day. Give me two calls that would absolutely scare the bejeez out of you, right?
Well, I think anybody that's in EMS would agree your biggest fear is driving up to a house or on a scene and having somebody come out and toss you a coding baby.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was my biggest fear
Absolutely.
So far. My second biggest fear was getting called to a scene and having to deliver a baby.
Absolutely. I completely agree with the two things that you just said wholeheartedly. And what's interesting now is that you are now a flight nurse here at Arkansas Children's on Angel One. And guess what? You might have to do every single shift. That's like one of your number one fortes, right? Like that's
yep.
what you guys train to do is take care of coding babies and birthing moms.
correct?
Right. So it's amazing we sometimes embrace what we fear, right?
Yeah.
So with that being said, you know, it kind of brings me to a point. You know, you guys train a lot. How much do you train? So I know I remember something about you guys training on individual age groups just for airway stuff. What does that look like?
Well, so every quarter, we're required to record intubations in the neonate, pediatric, and adult categories.
Okay.
We try to get those as live intubations in the field. But of course, we're a pediatric team, so the adult intubations are difficult to come by for us. But we do have some very realistic mannequins that we use. So we'll have someone watch us intubate those mannequins. But we have to record at least one of those in each category each quarter.
Each quarter. Okay.
Also each quarter, we go with our medical directors. We have a medical director for our neonatal side and then one for our pediatric side.
Sure.
And every other quarter, we'll do a neonatal scenario and then a pediatric scenario. And we go to our sim center with the interactive mannequins, and our medical directors come up with all kinds of scenarios for us, put us through the paces. So we have to run those scenarios, and then we do a debrief, and we're recorded while we do them. So we get to watch ourselves do well or not do well, and then we talk about it afterwards. And it's a learning piece for us. We have extensive training.
Absolutely. And I love what you're saying about the medical directors are so invested in that training.
Yes, they are. And they're super supportive. We also do case conference every month. And that's where we take cases that there are certain criteria that'll get a case pulled. Like if you have to change intubators or, you know, you're at the bedside over our allotted time,
right,
or anything out of the ordinary, we'll present it monthly in our case conference. Our medical directors are there.
Cool.
And we just talk about the case. It's not punitive. It's not pointing fingers. It's just, here's what happened. Here's why it happened. Mm-hmm. What can we do better? What are the learning points? And that way the whole team benefits from the experiences that each one of us have had.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's what sets you guys above. Another thing that I think really puts Angel One out there is the fact that you guys are busy. I know that we were trying to communicate last couple of days about this podcast and you were really busy.
Yes.
How many trips are like north of normal day?
Well, you know, it can vary. Sure. I've had shifts where we didn't do anything.
Right.
I've had shifts where you hit the door running and you didn't stop all day. Just like Monday when you and I were trying to communicate, I had lunch in the helicopter out of a box that was provided to me. So it can vary. But you have to be ready for all of it. And our families have to be very understanding as well, because we're scheduled for 12-hour shifts. Mm-hmm. But if the call comes in an hour before you get off and it's a day that the weather's bad and you have to drive, because we also go by ground anywhere we fly,
right.
You may not get off till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Right.
So our families have to be understanding. You have to be ready to take that on.
Yeah, I remember being on a trip and we were actually waiting on a mom to deliver a baby. And we were waiting on the mom for a really, really long time. Right. And it was like, okay, are we ever going to go back? The helicopter left us there because we were there so long. So these things can turn into a really long ordeal. And then I know you guys get late calls that throw you late getting out of here. Mm-hmm. Also, you guys have tried to combat that by staggering your shifts, but it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, we do the best we can, but
absolutely,
it's just an understanding when you get into this job. And I know these EMS guys watching this understand that.
Absolutely.
You are never guaranteed to get off at the end of your shift.
Absolutely.
And if you have plans, something's going to happen to make you get off late.
Okay, I'm going to put you back on that ambulance again. You're back in those VDUs and that flying cross. We get that call. So you've delivered a few babies in the field.
I have.
Tell us about those situations.
Okay. Well, the very first baby that I delivered in the field, I was fairly lucky to have a physician on board the ambulance with me. This woman was going into labor, and so she called her primary care doctor. And, you know, this is back in the day when the doctors you could call them at home.
That's hilarious.
And he told her, meet me at my office, and I'll meet you there at midnight. And so he got her there and assessed her and determined that she's going to have the baby. So he calls us at the ambulance station. We go pick her up. And he rides in the back with us.
Irma.
And the woman's laboring and we're monitoring her and I'm sweating bullets. I do not want to do this in the back of the truck.
Yeah.
We got about 10 miles and it was time to pull over and get the EMT back in the back with us because here comes the baby.
You know, thinking about that, we're going to talk about the reasons to pull over in a minute. But here, I think the anxiety with having a laboring mom is you know you're fixing to have two patients.
Yes.
Right? It's like, yes. Okay, this is fixing to double on me, right?
Right.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to completely
interrupt you. I mean, you're exactly right. You're going to have two patients, and the busiest one you're going to have is the one that was just born.
Yeah.
Of course. But keep in mind, you still have mom to take care of. Right. So don't forget about her. Now, mom usually is going to do okay by herself. But just don't forget about her.
Right.
But this baby delivered, I actually caught the baby. And my biggest fear then was don't drop it because, you know, it's there's a lot of fluids. It's very messy. They're slippery. Yeah. And so this doctor told me, he said, get a towel and drape it in your arms.
Sure.
That way you'll have a little more grip on the baby. And that was some good advice that I've taken with me from forever. But this delivery was pretty uneventful. The baby came out. It transitioned like it should. We did our suctioning and the baby did fine. And we were able to get on back to the road. All was well. I did not sleep the rest of that shift, even though we got back to the station about 3 a.m. Oh, man. Yes. Probably for 2 days. I was like on a high because I just delivered a baby in the field. So that's it was awesome. Really exciting.
That is. So I know that these days, I think they have a stork pin that they present to EMS folks deliver a baby. I've seen them wearing, they're proudly wearing their stork pin, right?
That's awesome.
So that's a
badge of honor.
So now that one went okay.
Yep.
You had one you were telling me about earlier that presented completely different.
Yes, we get called to a house and I could tell as soon as we walked in, we're not going anywhere. We're going to have to stay here and deliver.
Yeah.
So I felt fairly confident. You know, the first one went really well. I was like, I can do this. And then when she had a contraction and started pushing, I knew we were breached.
Oh, no.
So then I got nervous. So I went ahead and called medical control, let them know I'm at a house. We're going to have to deliver the baby and it's breech.
Oh, my.
So when the baby did deliver, the body delivered and one arm delivered, the other arm was up over the baby's head. The baby got stuck, like the chin, because it was face up as well. And every time mom would contract and push, not only was the baby getting compressed, but the cord was getting compressed and we were losing the pulse in the cord. And so I knew we were in a dire situation.
Right.
And I pulled the cord over to try to give the baby an airway and also keep the cord from being compressed. Luckily, that was enough to push the baby's chin down and the baby went ahead and delivered. So that was a big blessing.
Oh, wow.
And that baby did fine as well. So, but it was touch and go.
Yeah, I think
it was humbling, let me tell you.
Absolutely. And it's one of those times where you're like, okay, I can do this from now on. Like, nothing's going to faze me from now on, right? That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Did they name the kid Matt? Should have.
That was actually mentioned. I don't remember who it was. But somebody mentioned it, but they didn't end up doing it. That's fine.
Wonderful. And then you did another one after that.
I did one more. It was actually about 2 months after that one.
Right.
And that one was a straightforward delivery, no problems at all. But I can tell you, after that first one, I was very nervous again. but it went really well, no problems. So.
Okay, so let's talk about that situation. I think that, you know, here we are, we're transporting a mom that's having contractions. There's a few telltale signs, right? There's some things that generally let us know, like, this kid is coming right away, or I have time to give the old diesel bolus, right? For folks that don't know, a diesel bolus is stepping on the gas pedal on the ambulance and making it go faster,
right?
So what are those signs that will let me know that, hey, I need to think about finding a place to pull over, or we probably don't even need to leave the house because this baby's coming.
Yeah. So there are a few things that you need to know about mom and her pregnancy status before, like when you get there, you need to find out, is this her first pregnancy?
Sure.
If it's her first pregnancy, more than likely, now this is not an absolute, but more than likely, you've got a little more time. If it's her third, fourth, fifth pregnancy, you need to be a little more thinking a little more urgently because it's going to progress a lot faster. Her body knows what to do now. And it's probably going to come faster. You need to know, is this a single baby? Are there twins or triplets even in there?
Right.
Because, you know, you get one baby, be ready for another one if she's got twins. Yeah. And then you also want to know, has her amniotic bag broken? Has her water broken? And what was the consistency of it? Was it clear? Or did it have meconium in it? Was it greenish?
Okay.
Because if you've got meconium in there, then you need to start thinking about this baby's going to need rapid suctioning and could possibly have some complications with meconium aspiration.
Okay.
So you want to ask those things. Also, if her water is already broken, labor's more imminent.
Right.
So monitoring her contractions, you want to look, time them. If you're every 4 to 5 minutes on contractions and she tells you that they're becoming more intense, you're probably needing to stay or pull over because delivery is getting close. And then, of course, the absolute sign.
Sure.
We're crowning.
Yeah.
You're already delivering, basically.
You're not going to make it to the hospital.
No. And it's important to pull over. Do not try to keep going down the road and try to deliver the baby by yourself in the back of the truck. Because like I said, you're going to have two patients. You also have a lot to do.
Sure.
You need your partner's help. They can help hold the mom's legs. They can hand you equipment.
Sure.
You may have to resuscitate the baby. Mom's still going to need attention. So you both need to be in the back of the truck.
Okay.
If you've got fire department or first responders on scene, if you can get them to ride with you, that's even better.
Yeah.
More hands you can get, the better.
So we're going to pull over and we're going to deliver this baby. I want to know, give me a list of equipment. I think that there are some things that we may or may not remember to have assembled in the back of that ambulance.
Right. So hopefully you've got an OB kit on
board
your ambulance that will have lots of towels and cord clamps. You're going to need 2 cord clamps. You're going to need some scissors. Obviously, a bulb syringe for the baby. You need PPE for yourself because, like I said, this is a very messy process. Gowns, masks, face shield if you've got it. Those are all good things to have. Obviously, you want to have everybody in the back of the truck, all hands on deck. And then you want supplemental O2. You need all your airway stuff out, all your resuscitation stuff. And it needs to be out and ready to go. You don't need to be digging for it while you're trying to hold a baby or resuscitate a baby. So those are the basics.
So in the perfect world, would you have, while you're monitoring the mom, say you're the paramedic and you have an EMT driver, would you have your EMT like get all that stuff out and ready to go, kind of set it up for you?
Would you think
that would work?
Absolutely. If you feel even reasonably certain that this delivery may not wait until you get to the hospital,
sure,
I would have that stuff all out and ready.
Talk to me about the size of the back valve mask. And then talk to me about ET tube sizes. What ET tube sizes should I have out there and ready to go?
Okay. So as far as a bag and mask, what we use on Angel One, we use a typical little anesthesia mask, size 1 or even a 0 if you have it. We use the anesthesia bags,
Our
PR bags, the flow inflating bags.
Sure.
We like those because we can feel the compliance of the lungs. We're used to doing that, though.
Sure.
And you're not going to have that luxury on the ambulance.
No.
You have a self-inflating bag, and that's perfectly fine. We don't always use supplemental oxygen if we have to provide positive pressure ventilation for a baby.
Okay.
Because they don't always need the oxygen. They just sometimes need the pressure to pop open their alveoli and inflate their lungs and then stimulate them to breathe. Mm-hmm. So if you're using a self-inflating bag, not even hooked up to oxygen, that's okay. They don't all need 100%. Now, when you are bagging with a self-inflating bag, it's very difficult if you can feel a compliance at all. What you're looking for is chest rise, and don't look for great big chest rise because, I know when you ventilate an adult, you're going to see that big chest rise.
Sure.
You're just going to see a little bit of chest rise in a neonate. Small, adequate breaths, positioning the airway in a neutral to slightly hyperflexed position. Just give those little puffs
with that
bag.
Okay.
See that chest move just a little bit. Your best indication of your effectiveness of ventilation is your heart rate.
Okay.
So what you're going for is a heart rate over 100.
Okay.
If your heart rate is low when you first deliver and you're having to do PPV and your heart rate is responding and coming up, you're doing a good job.
Gotcha.
So that's your best thing to monitor.
Okay.
As far as ET tube sizes, the national, or the neonatal resuscitation program has a nice little graph. It's pretty easy to remember. If any of you have 2 ET tubes on your ambulance, I would encourage you either get rid of them if you can or don't use them, because really a 2-0 ET tube is just too small to do anything with. And it's actually fairly restrictive for airflow.
Okay.
So a 2.5 ET tube is basically the minimum we don't even carry anything less than that.
Gotcha.
You can get even a very premature, extreme low birth weight baby intubated with a 2.5 ET tube. So if your baby is less than 1,000 grams, 2.5 ET tube. And then 1,000 to 2,000, you go up to a 3.
Okay.
3,000 to 4,000, you're up to a 3.5.
Gotcha.
And then that can go on up to, you know, a five or whatever. But that's a good little, just every 1,000 grams, you're going to go up the next size tube.
How am I going to know how much they weigh, Matt?
Well, that's, you're going to have to estimate. There's also some resources out there that will give you estimated birth weights by gestational age. So if the mom tells you she's 35 weeks, you should be able to, you know, reference that. And if you can pull that up on your way to the scene, if you've got that information, then that's better for you. But a 35 weeker should be around 3 kilos.
Right.
So
just because if I don't have that app on my phone and I'm in this situation, could I call Angel One Dispatch and ask?
Absolutely, you can.
Yeah, I think that's a great option.
You can call Angel One Dispatch. They can hopefully get you hooked up with a nurse that is on duty if we're not all out on calls and help get you that information.
That's a really good resource. Okay, so we kind of talked through equipment. I think that equipment is one of those things that it's going to be hard, especially for an ambulance service that sees all mostly adults, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe some kids, but just they're never going to see a neonate. So you're going to have a lot of equipment that may be been sitting in a bag for years and never looked at. So I really implore you to get in your ambulance and look through your equipment and make sure your stuff is still good, because those things dry rot, right? I mean, they get stiff,
but also just looking at it and putting your hands on it and becoming familiar with it.
Yeah.
It's much easier to do something, especially something stressful, if you're familiar with your equipment, than to try to figure it out in the moment.
There's a lot of superstition around that. You're not supposed to look at that PD bag because then you're going to get a PD call, right? So I'm just going to spend just a little bit more time on equipment, and I promise we're going to move on to delivering this baby. The mom is just waiting to deliver this baby while we're talking about equipment. So these ET tubes that you're describing, they are cuffless. Is that correct?
They are uncuffed ET tubes. Yes. Okay. Yes.
So
if all you have is a cuff tube, that's fine.
Okay.
But if you need to go down a size with the cuff tube, of course, don't do a 2-0.
Okay.
But if you have cuff tubes and that's all you have, then just go down a half size.
Okay.
And then use that. One other thing with intubation that I think is important to
note. Okay, good.
I know you guys are used to intubating older kids and adults, and you get your view with the laryngoscope and there's nice pretty white cords and you're like, there's the glottic opening. That's where I go.
Right.
The cords on a neonate are not white.
Okay.
Everything down there is pink.
Gotcha.
And so it's harder to see. There's also going to be a lot more fluid down there because they've just come out of a fluid-filled environment.
Sure.
You just kind of have to know your anatomy, know where that glottic opening should be. And sometimes we just have to watch for the bubbles. And if the bubbles are coming out, just go for the bubbles.
Gotcha.
So
is there any truth to this? And I've heard this several times, but if you look at, are you doing a direct look, right? And you're looking down your laryngoscope blade and you're not seeing anything, you're probably too deep.
Yes. Yes. So if you do that and all you're seeing is just the esophagus, just keep your upward traction and just gently slide back onto your laryngoscope. And then that, glottic opening should drop down at the end of the tube at some point.
Okay.
And you probably will feel it, but you'll also see it. So as far as access goes, on the really premature babies, you know, we know they're going to need access for a long time. Their veins are tiny, their skin's thin. So we just go ahead and do umbilical lines. Now that's kind of it's a sterile procedure. It's a central line. So that's something that needs to be done in a controlled environment by somebody that's trained to do it. I don't expect EMS providers to be able to do that.
It takes a lot of time as well.
It does. Yeah. Set up and prep and everything is a big deal. So as far as EMS or pre-hospital environment goes, if you can get a PIV, that's great. 24 gauge, that's fine.
Sure.
Don't try to get anything bigger than that. Tops of the hands are good places.
Sure.
The saphenous vein down by the ankle is a good place. Don't be afraid to do a scalp vein.
Okay.
They're still a peripheral IV. The only really drawback to a scalp vein is the parents don't like to see it because it's a little scary looking, but it's just as good as a peripheral IV. Just when you're doing scalp veins, make sure that you're always pointing the catheter down
towards the heart.
It doesn't need to go up towards the scalp. It needs to be going the right way. And that's fine. If you cannot get IV access and your baby is needing resuscitation, then you always have the ability to do an IO.
Okay, we covered a whole bunch of stuff right there. So let's back up. We've got our equipment out. We're in the back of the truck. We've got our people back there. Mm-hmm. We're ready to have a baby. Just walk me through one more time what a normal delivery looks like. And then what are some of those things that I'm worried about? Give me a couple of those worrisome things that could happen. And then kind of tell me what I should do if that happens.
Okay. So normal presentation. You got mom in that dorsal lithotomy position.
Sure.
You see the head crowning. Okay. Here it comes. So the baby should present face down. That's normal. As that head is coming out, get you a towel, kind of drape it over your forearms. You want to provide a little bit of gentle pressure against that baby's head because you don't, that head is the biggest part.
And
once it passes through, everything can just shoot right out.
Right.
And I'm saying that it really can.
Comes out fast.
So you want to have control.
Okay.
Once that head comes out, what should happen then is the baby should rotate to one side or the other about 90 degrees.
Sure.
To face one of mom's thighs.
Okay.
And what that does is it positions the shoulders, and it's just kind of a natural thing.
Right.
Positions the shoulders for optimal delivery. Once the head comes out and then the shoulders pass through, the rest of it is a foregone conclusion, basically.
Gotcha.
Just be ready to catch the baby and all of that. So that's a normal presentation of birth.
Right.
There are some things that can happen, like shoulder dystocia.
But you were talking about that earlier. Yeah.
Yes. So risk factors for shoulder dystocia. Mm-hmm. If mom is way past her due date.
Okay.
If she's diabetic, either diabetic all the time or if she has gestational diabetes, they have big babies.
Okay,
that's a common thing. So be aware that if mom's diabetic or gestational diabetic, you could have an unusually large baby.
Okay.
And shoulder dystocia should be on your radar.
We were also talking earlier about prolapsed cord. So what does that look like?
So if you do an examination on mom and you see the umbilical cord sticking out, that's a prolapsed cord. You can also, infrequently with a prolapsed cord, there may be a presenting part as well. There may be a foot sticking out. There may be an arm sticking out. So what you need to do then is encourage the mother not to push.
Gotcha.
Get her in the Trudellenburg position. Now, if delivery is imminent and you can't stop it, of course, you've got to go ahead and deliver. Just know that this cord is going to be compressed during the entire delivery process. So you may have a baby you're going to have to resuscitate.
Yeah.
So that's a good time to try and get mom to the hospital as quickly as possible, because ideally she needs a C-section.
So what's the difference in prolapsed cord and nuchal cord? What's a nuchal cord?
So a nuchal cord is when the cord gets wrapped around the neck of the baby. And you typically won't see that until the baby is presenting. So as you're delivering the baby and you're providing that support of the head, one thing you need to do is take your finger and kind of sweep up the neck, because if there is a loop around the cord, and it can loop more than once sometimes.
I know. That's terrible.
But before the baby comes out and really stretches that cord tight, you can hook your finger around that cord and slip it up over the baby's head to reduce that.
Okay. All right. So let's just say our baby in this situation comes out normal. We have a baby that's delivered in our arms. What next? What do we do next? We got this slippery baby in our arms that you're saying we shouldn't drop. We better be careful. So what do we do next? What do we do with this child?
So what you want to do is get your bulb syringe, suction the nares and then the mouth.
Okay.
And then with that towel, provide drying and stimulation.
Okay.
Because the baby's going to be a little bit stunned and you want to get them stimulated.
What color is this baby going to be?
It's going to be blue. Expect it to be blue. So fairly vigorous stimulation with the drying and all that kind of stuff. Don't worry about cutting the cord yet. They're actually incorporating into practice more and more delayed cord clamping.
Okay.
And what that does is it gives some time for the blood that's in the placenta to go ahead and auto transfuse into the baby.
Nice.
So they get some benefits from that. So don't worry about cutting the cord right away. That's fine. They're going to be fine. But you can hold the baby at the level of mom or even a little bit below mom to kind of facilitate that auto transfusion. So drying and stimulation, trying to get the baby to breathe, all that kind of stuff. If the baby starts breathing and is crying and, you know, vigorous and all that, then you're in good shape.
Gotcha.
Then the next thing is babies get cold very quickly.
Okay.
So skin to skin with mom. That's the best thing you can do in the pre-hospital environment to warm that
with
baby
the cord
up.
On. Baby's,
cord on. Yeah.
Baby's crying, probably starting to turn a little bit pink. We're just going to put the baby right on mom.
Now, if the baby cries a little bit and then stops breathing or is just kind of making a lackluster effort, then that's when you want to put your bag mask on and do some PPB.
Okay.
Now, it's important to note, in neonatal resuscitation, most often, only basic interventions are required.
Okay.
You're just trying to get that baby's lungs opened up, get them stimulated, get them used to breathing, that kind of stuff. So you may have to do some PPB. You may only have to do it for 30 seconds. I mean, that's not uncommon. And then they may go ahead and transition and do well.
Okay. Let's stop just for just a second right there. So positive pressure ventilation to get the lungs opened up. And that's what you're saying to me, but why are the lungs closed?
Well, they're not full of air because they've been.
What are they full of?
They're full of fluid.
So
they're not opened up. They're still kind of collapsed. So there are a lot of things that occur when the baby's born within the baby's body that kind of trigger all these things to say, hey, okay, we've been doing it this way. Now we need to do it this way. But you can facilitate that with positive pressure ventilation. It does a number of things. It helps to manually pop those lungs open and those alveoli open because of the pressure. But the pressure will also help facilitate movement of that fluid from the lungs into the vasculature to open them up and clear them. But then it also stimulates the baby, stimulates them to breathe. And like we talked about earlier, your best indicator of effective ventilation is your heart rate.
Okay.
So the best way you can monitor your heart rate is you can feel the umbilical stump and there should be a pulse in it. Brachial is a good place. But if you've got a pulse ox, neonatal pulse ox probe, and you can put it on their right hand, then you can monitor your heart rate and your pulse ox at the same time. And that's what we use.
So what am I looking for? What is normal heart rate right when I first get this baby out?
So your goal is to have the heart rate over 100.
Okay. So we're trying to get to 100. What is the point where I get worried and have to start doing stuff?
Well, if your heart rate is below 100 and above 60, you need to be providing some
positive pressure,
ventilation and all of that. You're not looking for 100% pulse ox. I know everybody wants that 100% pulse ox. Babies are not going to give you that. Even a healthy baby with no complications that's transitioning well is not going to give you 100% pulse
ox. What's normal?
65%, 60 to 65% at 1 minute of life.
Okay.
That you're okay.
Good.
As long as your heart rate's good.
Okay. 65% pulse ox at 1 minute of life is okay.
And then you should watch that trend upwards. To where even at 10 minutes, you may not be at 100%. You may be at 90 to 95. You're still okay. You're in the good range.
Gotcha.
So don't look for that 100%. That doesn't mean you're not doing well.
Focus
that
on the heart.
The baby is still transitioning.
Gotcha. Focus on the heart rate.
Focus on the heart rate and the respiratory effort.
Now, you said something about 60. After it's below, when it gets below 60, then what am I doing?
Anything below 60, you're going to be doing chest compressions.
Gotcha.
Yep. But don't forget, while you're doing chest compressions, you need to also be doing the PPB because that's your driver for your heart rate.
What is my chest compression to ventilation ratio for that little neonate? I just
15 to 1.
15 to 1. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And if you're intubated, just continuous breaths with compressions.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just want our baby just to do good and be on mom's chest. And here's the thing. We got that baby on mom's chest and we're still crying. We're still looking okay.
Mm-hmm.
When do I cut the cord?
So you know, 30 seconds is what they're doing right now.
Okay.
It's not going to hurt if you waited longer than that.
Okay.
As long as the cord has a pulse in it, you're okay. Once the cord doesn't have a pulse, you can cut it.
Okay.
But you don't have to wait for that.
Okay.
30 seconds is adequate. If everything is transitioning and flowing great and you're doing well and the baby's doing well, then 30 seconds, you can clamp and cut. Now, when you clamp the cord, you want to give ideally about 10 centimeters from the baby.
From the baby.
That's a lot of cord.
Sure.
I'm talking about that
much. Saving yourself some stump there to work with for
because
central lines.
Because if the baby needs central lines later, then they've got plenty of cord to work with.
Okay.
So you can't leave it too long.
Sure.
Clamp it, and then about 5 more centimeters up, clamp it again. And then in between those two clamps is where you'll cut.
Okay. So what if we are worried about mom being hypertensive and have lost a lot of blood? And
hopefully you got an IV on mom before you had to deliver and all that kind of stuff. But you definitely need to get an IV on mom because if she does have postpartum hemorrhage, then you're going to need to do some volume resuscitation and things like that. Yeah.
So just like a leader in on the way to the hospital, something like that, wide open.
It's just you're going to treat her basically like your hypovolemic shock patients
Absolutely.
At that point.
So we talked a little bit about resuscitation. You gave a really good picture of what that looks like on the normal side. But what if that baby's not breathing? That baby's refusing to breathe when they come out. They're blue. Can't get them stimulated. I've tried to stimulate them. Let's talk about that. And then don't let me forget how to transport this baby to keep them warm other than skin to skin.
Okay. So if the baby is not breathing and just will not have any effort, then of course you're in a full resuscitation at that point.
Okay.
You need to get a definitive airway if you can with an ET tube.
Okay.
And then secure it. Now they're going to be really wet. They may have vernix caseosum on them. Clean that off the best you can and take the tube down because you don't want it coming out. That's bad form. Then, you know, just do your ventilations. And if you have to do compressions, you have to do compressions. If the baby just does not respond, then you're going to go to epi and give your doses of epi.
Okay.
And then you should be en route to the hospital by the time you're doing that.
Yeah, so, it sounds like a time where you need to be getting down the road for sure. Okay. Yeah. So we talked about the difference in resuscitation from neonate, infant, and pediatric. So what about meconium aspiration?
Basically, when you see a baby that has meconium in their fluid or their meconium stained as they're coming out, then you need to have your suction ready, because as soon as that head presents, you need to vigorously and aggressively suction that airway out, because you're trying to get that meconium out of their airway and cleared before they take their first breath. So
gotcha.
They don't pull it down into their lungs, because then you got a sick baby for sure.
For sure.
So get that meconium all cleared out. Not every meconium baby is going to need to be intubated. Mm-hmm. You know, they may go ahead and transition fine and do well. You're just going to have to monitor them and see how they do.
Right.
But basically, you're just in the pre-hospital setting. You're going to treat them like every other baby that's born once you get that meconium out. And then if you need to intubate them, you do. And then you can suction down the tube and try to get any other meconium out that's in there. But if you've suctioned their airway out and they transition well and they're breathing on their own, no distress, and they're doing fine, that's all you need to do.
So I want to get to those specialized things that Angel One does. But before we get there, just highlight some of the reasons why, some of the kind of pathophysiology, some of the diagnoses that we're looking at that could possibly make that neonate need resuscitation.
Sure. So babies can have all kinds of things. We try to catch a lot of things prenatally if we can with ultrasound and lab and things like that. But even in the best prenatal care, some things slip through the cracks.
Sure.
We get babies that are born at hospitals and, you know, they're a few hours old even. And as their ductus is closing, we discover, oh, they've got a cardiac issue that was undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
So cardiovascular disorders are a big thing. And if you have a baby that is, you know, you're ventilating and their pulse ox is not responding, their heart rate's not really responding and stuff, it may be a cardiac issue. Maybe their plumbing is not right.
Sure.
So just keep that on your radar. There's not much you can do about that pre-hospital.
Right.
Just keep it on your radar. Another thing is the pneumothorax.
Sure.
You know, their lungs are just now opening up and becoming compliant and working and doing what they're supposed to do, exchanging the gases, taking the air in and out, and then the perfusion has to take place. All those things have to start occurring that haven't been occurring up until that moment.
Right.
Especially if you've had to provide PPB.
Right.
That's it's easy to overpressurize and cause some barrel trauma.
Sure.
So you can get a pneumothorax. So be aware that that is a possibility. One thing you can do in the field to check for that, and we do this as well sometimes. The gold standard, of course, is an X-ray.
Right.
But you can turn the lights off in your ambulance, get it as dark as you possibly can, and get a bright light and what we call transilluminate the chest.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at both sides of the chest and you've got one side that lights up like a lantern and the other side doesn't, this side probably has a pneumothorax. And if you're listening and you're not hearing air exchange on that side and the baby is showing signs of a tension pneumothorax, then you can decompress that just like you would any other tension pneumothorax. You're going to go in the midclavicular line, second intercostal space, put your needle in there and get that air out.
I love that. I think that that's the kind of thing that we always hold on to, right? That's a game changer.
Absolutely.
And I love that turning the lights out and using a transilluminator with your mag light, right?
Yeah.
So that's a really good takeaway right there. Anything else come to mind that could cause?
Well, one thing with babies is they're used to getting their sugar and everything from mom. And that's just been cut off abruptly. Mm-hmm. They don't have a lot of sugar stores. They, you know, they got some glycogen stores, but those are going to deplete pretty quickly.
Right.
And especially if a mom is diabetic or has gestational diabetes.
Gotcha.
They are used to higher insulin levels and higher sugar levels and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You just absolutely cut the cord on that, literally.
Literally, yeah.
And so they can become hypoglycemic. So getting a point of care glucose okay. is important. And you want to treat that.
Sure.
If it's we use 40 kind of as our marker for okay. when we need to treat hypoglycemia and when we don't. If they're over 40, they're okay. If you can get an IV and start their, we use D10, 10% dextrose.
Okay.
And we use that for a maintenance fluid. If they're over 40, you can get the IV and get their D10 started, you're okay. Unless it's an infant of a diabetic mother, then you need to continually monitor their glucose to make sure they can still dip below that threshold.
Gotcha.
If they go below that threshold, then we'll do a D10 bolus. Okay. And basically what we do is 2 to 3 mils per kilogram of a D10 bolus in their IV.
Okay.
Do not use D50 on a DNA.
Gotcha, gotcha.
I don't know. Everybody's got that on their trucks. And D25 is really not even good. We just used D10, right. 2 to 3 mils per kilo. Give that as a bolus, and that should be enough to get them up. But if it's a diabetic mom, you need to keep checking it.
Can we highlight some of the things that you guys bring? So just to give the picture, give the view of where we're going. So we're starting out in the back of this ambulance that we pulled over on the side of the road, and we delivered this baby. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take this baby to one of those primary or secondary hospitals out there, right? And then you guys are going to come to get the mom or get the baby. What are some of the things that you guys could bring? What are some of those specialties that you guys carry around?
Well, so, you know, let's just talk about one of the complications like shoulder dystocia.
Sure.
If you have a baby that has shoulder dystocia and it was a difficult delivery, the baby was stuck for a while, was really stunned at delivery, you had to do a lot of resuscitation, and then the baby's just making not much effort on their own, their tone is floppy, those kind of things, you're going to need to start thinking about this. This baby could have HIE, which is hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy.
Okay.
Their brain has gone for an extended period of time without oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so one of the therapies that we can provide for that is whole body cooling, therapeutic hypothermia.
Wow.
And we can bring that to the bedside wherever the baby is. But a good pre-hospital history is important for that. We need to know what happened during that delivery. How long was the baby stuck? What interventions did you have to do to resuscitate that baby? Mm-hmm. And how did the baby respond?
Gotcha.
Because those are going to be drivers for us, whether or not this baby meets criteria. There's other things like they have to be 34 to 35 weeks gestational age. Mm-hmm. We'll get blood gases, or the hospital that the baby receives the baby will get blood gases. And if there's any arterial blood gas, whether it's cord or from the baby, that has a pH of below 7, that's going to be criteria. And then we do an exam called a SARNAT exam. We test reflexes and pupils and tone and suck reflex, all that kind of stuff. And all of those pieces together will help make the decision on whether we're going to provide the cooling for the baby.
Gotcha. Wow.
So a good history of what happened at delivery is very important.
Yeah. So if I report to you that we had to do chest compressions for 40 seconds, a minute,
that's probably important to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. What's another thing that you guys bring out on the Angel One besides the beautiful Sikorsky helicopter?
So on all our neonatal trips, we bring a Bronchotron, which is basically an oscillatory ventilator. Wow. And then we also carry nitric oxide. Those are going to be things that might be important if you have a meconium aspiration baby, because they're at high risk to develop pulmonary hypertension. Now, your infants of diabetic mothers are going to be at risk for that as well. That's part of that process. So oscillatory ventilation, I don't know if everybody's heard of that, but basically what it is, where it differs is conventional ventilation, and this is very simplified, you give a big breath in and a big breath out.
Right.
Just like we're breathing right now. Big breath in, big breath out. Okay. If you've got sick lungs, meconium aspiration, pulmonary hypertension, whatever it is, their lungs don't do well with that kind of ventilation.
Okay.
So oscillatory ventilation is basically, if you think about a dog that's hot, how they pant and they breathe real fast with shallow breaths, that's kind of what the oscillator or our transport version of that is called a Bronchotron.
Okay.
That's what it does. It gives quick, fast puffs of breath. And we're not looking for big chest rise and stuff. We're just looking for what we call chest wiggle.
Wiggle. Got it.
And so the unhealthy lungs tend to do better with that kind of ventilation. It doesn't cause barotrauma. And you can usually, you dial in a mean airway pressure with that you can maintain all the time.
Okay.
It helps to open those up and all that.
So when you dial in that mean airway pressure, does that kind of dictate the tidal volume, or and how does that set up? Is there a,
that is just strict. It's kind of like, peep on a conventional ventilation. You know, you don't want to on a, on your breath out, you don't want to just not have any back pressure at all. Because then your lungs are just going to collapse. You have all kinds of atelectasis. So you provide PEEP, which is positive and expiratory pressure, to help hold those, even though you're letting the air out of them, there's still some back pressure to keep those airways opened up.
Okay.
So mean airway pressure kind of does the same thing. It's the constant pressure of that airway. You're not just letting it open to atmosphere with no back pressure at all. So that's your mean airway pressure. Then we have some other adjustments we make, like amplitude and frequency and that kind of stuff, like how fast are the puffs.
And it's too.
And then the amplitude is kind of, if you think about amplitude, it's up and down. So how big of a puff you're giving them, basically.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I guess that would be the equivalent of tidal volume.
Kind of is, yeah.
Okay. So the oscillator, bronchotron, that's crazy to think about. And it's just amazing to see that you guys bring all this out and able to do that. And what's something else that we frequently bring with us?
Well, like I mentioned, the nitric oxide. So if the bronchotron or the oscillatory ventilation is not effective, not getting us where we need to be, we can add in nitric oxide. So it's a gas that we put an additional line on the circuit to pipe it into their circuit and into their ventilation.
Sure.
And what it does, you know, there's two parts to ventilation and perfusion. There's the ventilation side, getting the air in and out of the lungs. Then there's the perfusion side,
right,
getting the blood to the lung beds to exchange those gases.
Okay.
Because you can ventilate the lungs all day long. If you don't have the perfusion side, you're not doing any good. What's the point? So the nitric oxide can help, and this is really helpful with pulmonary hypertension. It can help to dilate those capillary beds into the lung fields, get that blood flowing and get it where it needs to be so that it can exchange the gases in the alveoli and make your ventilation effective. So
dilator.
We bring that with us as well. So
I love that.
Yeah.
And I know you've seen this over and over and over. Those things work. Amazing.
They do.
Right.
Yeah. If you've ever, and I know the EMS guys can relate to this, you've been on a diabetic call where blood sugar is nothing.
Right.
And you give them their D50 through their IV line and they wake up miraculously and everybody thinks you're a hero. And you're like, yeah, I did that. So it's almost that way with nitric oxide. A lot of times you can show up at a place where they've just been struggling to get this baby sat up and we've done everything we can do. We just can't get it there. And then we can just hook up our nitric oxide and watch it just climb right up to normal range.
Yeah.
Like, no, we're good.
That's so amazing.
It doesn't always work that way.
No,
but it is satisfying.
So you guys have a ton of resources that you bring with you and makes me so proud to know that we offer that support across the state of Arkansas. It makes me really proud. I just want to talk about one last thing with you, Matt. And you've been here for 19 years at Arkansas Children's Hospital, and I cannot imagine the amount of days that you went home with a heavy heart, with a sad heart, right?
Yeah.
I've been there with you. We've been in the ER together, and I know I left and cried tears on the way home. People ask me all the time. They're like, how do you do that? How do you do that job? Especially EMS providers, the last thing we want to do is take care of a pediatric patient, right? So how do you cope?
So I know I certainly, as my paramedic career unfolded, I saw things I never imagined I would ever see. And I know these guys watching, the same story is true to them. Everybody has their own coping mechanisms. I'm sure it's a little different when you're on the hospital side of things because you're not seeing the messiness of the scene and all of that. But there's also the family aspect of it that we deal with. So there's everybody's looking at their facet of it. I think a good home balance is good. If you've got, and certainly good support from your employer, you need a supervisor that's going to check on you. If you need to have a debrief, then that's something that's very important to do. And on those debriefs, I cannot stress enough that it is important to have that be therapeutic and educational, not punitive, not finger pointing, not accusatory.
I agree.
There should be no judgment, and whatever is said and transpires in that room needs to stay there. But I'm also fortunate enough to be married to a nurse, and I know you are as well. So that's a great thing. I can go home and talk to my wife, and mm-hmm. she knows what I'm talking about, and she understands, and she doesn't always have to really respond even, other than just to listen. So that's important. And then, you know, don't forget about your colleagues. You can always talk with your colleagues. Healthy, and these are all the things they teach you, you know, exercise, healthy diet, all of those kind of things, work-life balance. If you're working all the time, which I know when I worked EMS, I worked as much overtime as I could get my hands on.
Me too.
And there were days, I mean, I actually worked several 96-hour shifts because it just worked out that way. And you need to have that downtime and that personal time to decompress, process. You know, that's just vitally important.
I always encourage people, and I love to ask people this question that have been in the position that you're in, because it lets everybody out that they're listening and gives them an example of, hey, we should probably do that, right?
Right.
So I think that's super important. I cannot say enough how much I appreciate you having this conversation with me. I think we covered a lot of things.
I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate you inviting me.
It's been really a treat. It's a silly question, but I absolutely know you love your job here. And you've probably answered this before, but what's your favorite thing about what you do?
I can tell you unequivocally, the most satisfying part of my job is the autonomy. You can certainly relate to that, being in the pre-hospital environment, being a paramedic. You were out with your partner. It was just you. You made the decisions. You made the calls. You made it happen. And then having that opportunity to go out and be the extension of the physician at the referring hospital, making those decisions, interpreting those blood gases, doing vent changes, giving meds and all those kind of things. It's just that the autonomy for me is the most satisfying part.
Right. I love it. Thank you so much. If you're going to claim your CEUs, if you're a paramedic or an EMT and you're going to claim your CEUs after watching this podcast, please reach out to Kelly Tolliver at EMSC. And the code word is going to be Angel One. So Angel One is the code word to put in your email to Kelly Tolliver to get your CEUs. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for joining. Thank you for listening. And have a great day and be safe.